If you would please take your seats, we'll get started here. I'd like to. There's room up front, not church, come on down. Lots of good old faces, some new faces in the crowd. Tom Richmond will not be here today. Tom actually had to stay in California. He asked me, Milt Rhodes, if I would fill in as moderator today. We have Tom Lowe in the dark jacket and Wesley Horner in the blue jacket here that are on the schedule. I'd also like to point out that my name is spelled R-H-O-D-E-S. There's no A in it. That's printed in the trademark. So if you type an email to mrose@urlworks.com, make sure you leave the A out of it. Thanks, guys, for being here. This is, the second or third specific session at a Congress for New Urbanism on stormwater and urbanism. And I think that's an exciting opportunity for urbanists, for landscape designers, for architects, for planners, for other folks that are working in a field and trying to integrate ecological practices into urbanistic practices in a way that is innovative. So I look forward to the next several years of great design innovations. There have been quite a few in the last few years, and we'll see some of those examples today in the presentation. I wanted to put a few questions out there before we got started with their presentation as to why we even have a conversation about stormwater design in a conference on urbanism. And we are the Congress for the New Urbanism. We are taking back our streets, taking back our cities, making new places great. And it's our responsibility, I think, you often argue with me at the salon, it's our responsibility to do better, to continue to do better, to continue to improve, to push those limits. We have that, I think, as an obligation. And how can we do that? We can do that by asking new questions, sometimes asking the same old question a different way and to different people. The integrated nature of ecological practices in urbanism requires that you ask many, many different people in order to come up with an answer that I think is satisfactory for the time being and works well into the future. When do you need to do this sort of planning? You know, so many times, at least from the past experience I've had, the stormwater plan comes after the design is in place, after a lot of the architecture is done, after even the bulk of the road engineering comes. You ever talk to a stormwater engineer and he'll say, pipe it, put it in the ditch in the back of the lot. Well, for new urbanism, it may need to come earlier than that. It does need to come earlier than that. And for why and for what are you doing this for? Well, you're doing this to meet regulatory requirements from the state, federal, and local agencies that you work with. But you're also doing it because you create amenities, you create healthy aquatic habitats, you create all kinds of different good things for the place that you're working. Today, Tom and Wesley will talk about stormwater integration and projects at different scales of intensity, from a low scale to an ultra-urban situation. I think we've got some really nice examples. If we need to come back and continue with more examples, I can pull some up too. I just wanted to, since there's some new folks coming in, we have Tom Lowe and Wesley Horner. Tom Lowe works with DPZ in Charlotte. As the director of the Charlotte office, and he's going to say some other things about himself, I hope. And Wesley is a planner with Cahill Associates here in the Philadelphia area, and they've worked all over the country doing some very innovative engineering when it comes to stormwater and specific design challenges. My name is Milt Rhodes. I live in Raleigh, North Carolina. I am a planner and environmental planner working for New Urban Water Works, a firm that specializes in specific design interventions dealing with stormwater and other ecological practices. Okay, some challenges to put out there, and nothing can get going. A challenge for folks working in this field and ways to apply the methods to meet these challenges is stormwater. What do we do? It's our enemy. We want to get it away from buildings. We want to get it away from our basements. We want to get it out of the area as much as we can because it can create a nuisance. But we can look toward nature for ideas on how to manage this stuff while keeping it an amenity for our site. Our structures that we design should be legible. We should be able to read them as rational reasons for why they're in a place. They should make sense. They shouldn't confuse us or make us say, huh, that's not right. A regulatory goal that we need to practice as much as we can is to try and mimic the pre-development conditions on the site. When we can't, we have to go to other mechanisms. So one thing we've learned from the watershed planners is to try and manage as much of this rainwater at the source, where it first falls and collects, so that we can avoid long runs of big pipes and big things at the end of those big pipes. And these little micro-site controls that pop up in places around really give us a tremendous new opportunity to integrate into our new area. So I think we'll go ahead, Tom. So you may have to hold this. You may talk loud enough. But you know, I'm trying to hold it.
Wow, stormwater. Look at the crowd.
Yeah, all
right. We've got a competition out there. Some great sessions right now. I wanted to introduce, this isn't an I thing, it's a we thing. It's a group that's been working and pushing this idea forward. And they're in the room, around in the room, and I'd like for them to stand, the DPZ folks in Charlotte, so you can see them. Where are they? There's one in the back. This guy Perlman with his hand up. Put your hands up. Patrick. Lauren. Monica. And Norm may be here also. And then Patrick and Warren may didn't come up and show this one. This is something fresh off the plotter that that we've been working on because we've been collecting stormwater pools and trying to organize them into a transect matrix. And that's what this is right here. And this is the second. We had three opportunities to talk about this during the session. The first one. Okay, well, it's too small to read. Okay, so now you've seen it. Okay, wait. Just to show you, just look at the number. I think I asked Catherine, how many do we have? And I said about 60 pools. And what we're trying to do is actually create a framework to do a better job of stormwater management as one tool about how to do better new urbanism in terms of community related to sustainable practices. So, and we had a great session as part of the new initiative session on Thursday. And then tonight, if the boxing match gets boring, you can come over and hang out with our salon. Because what we'd like to do is take this and actually make it more real. Anyone who has an idea about this particular topic, we'd like you to come over and actually work with us to figure out where it fits within this framework, and that's the whole idea. And so that's kind of a starting point. Thanks, Patrick. But also, besides myself, other folks with DPZ will be there tonight, and anyone else that's been contributing to this. There's a PhD engineer and a few people like that have been really involved with this to really make it real. The thing that, you know, all of you know is that most of us are generalists, and I know very little about this topic as a specialist. But as a person in the trenches, I understand the importance of doing something besides the kind of default mechanisms we're doing now, which is basically the kind of dumbed down approach that Mel just mentioned. And clearly, you know, this is a very, you know, the greening of America, the new red, white, and blue is green, Friedman's way of talking about it. is really what's happening now. And people like Starbucks, which say things like, you know, environmental impact, reducing environmental impact through certain things. Clearly, there's a lot of challenges out there. This is kind of their iconic image, but this is what they're doing now when they're thrown out into the burbs, because there's no mechanism. And basically, what they're doing is selling coffee as a prime objective. But the fact that their image could be so much more if they thought about it in a lot better terms is kind of. Now, what this also represents is the kind of the low impact DMP. Gold standard. This is what it looks like. And this is what our country is going to become. This is kind of a sleeping crisis right now that many of you recognize. There's some great discussions on like those sort of like ProHerb that talk about the fact that a lot of municipalities across the country by default are adopting low impact LID standards. And what it's going to do is actually create within these types of places, this type of community environment, which all of us realize is actually a horrendous thing. And if we don't get our act together and actually come up with a framework that is powerful enough to actually compete with low impact, then we're basically going to lose the battle. And that's the reason why we came up with this bumper sticker called Light Imprint, which we can talk lots of different things, and we're welcome to the idea of changing the name, but the idea of saying, at least in the coast, adopt low impact and light imprint, or maybe they'll actually get a typo and just put in LI, and we can say, oh, you meant light imprint. So that's the idea. It's all about, it's 90% marketing, but the key is actually getting it out there. And it's something that, a few New Urbanists know how to do really, really well, and the reason why we've been successful with things like smart codes, actually even champion that way as a collective board. So that's what we're here to do, and we welcome your expertise and anybody that wants to get involved, so that we don't end up with this type of environment in terms of saving the environment with coffee. Now, this is obviously the tool that we want to use is the transect, and actually plugging in the tools in the right place, in the right location, so that instead of coming out one piece at a time and doing office parks with low impact and BMPs and shopping malls and housing subdivisions, which have all the kind of great stuff environmentally, we actually develop real coherent neighborhoods that are connected and complete and all the other wonderful things about them. So that when you get into, and in this particular case, this particular case study I wanted to present is just one little piece of what the potential is. Because what we're talking about now is going is actually looking at, infill locations, but also there's a huge amount of greenfield opportunities, but areas that are actually going to happen either with, sprawl or actually with us, trying to come in and do better things. So this type of kind of rural crossroads with, these kind of suburban subdivisions popping up, and the fact that this is designated as a commercial node, and what people are thinking about is are three power centers or four power centers at that intersection, when actually this type of natural drainage system exists, and these rural communities also exist within that, and now these kind of yellowish subdivisions are popping up. If we can create a framework that's more like this, where actually you're looking at those types of things and connecting it together and thinking about the idea of forming new villages and towns set in open space, which is the model at the regional level, which is another matrix besides this one, then we may have a fighting chance. So that these types of rural crossroads, and this was just in the last presentation that some of you may have gone, that Seth Perry did, the idea of creating the beginnings of the stuff on the side of the highway, is actually creating real towns again. And so this site was a case study that we did in Greenville, South Carolina, actually the county of Greenville, outside of Greenville, South Carolina, which, by the way, is a fabulous town, best-kept secret place. Any of you ever want to see a great place, with an incredible greenway coming right through the center of Main Street. And we did a standard 300-acre proposal that's an alternate to a suburban subdivision with a power center on the corner. We're actually, we're creating the village concept. And then we actually did a very coherent first phase in 60 acres as kind of the starter village. And we did all the good things that we've been doing for the last 25 years in terms of our design techniques. And then we stepped back and evaluated, because the engineering came in, and we said, well, let's look at it let's take one more look at it because there's some opportunities here. And the client, our client, Joe Jelks, who maybe you're also, is Joe in the room? I'm sure he's here. Was very interested, and the county was very interested, and an organization called Upstate Forever was supportive of the idea. And we took this plan, and we actually applied the standard transect from T4, T3, and T2. This is a standard process. And then we evaluated a completely engineered plan and compared it to the potential of more of a light imprint approach. And basically this approach, and this is interesting because there's been a lot of studies that compare conventional suburban with traditional neighborhood or new urbanism. There are tons of those out now, and they all are basically saying the right thing. That, you know, the new urbanist projects work better for a wide variety of reasons. So we actually said, why don't we take a conventional new urbanist project and then compare it to a light imprint new urbanist project in the same way, which is, you know, the next step up is, you know, evaluating our own work. And so we took this, which is basically the conventional engineering for a new urbanist project, which what I call is the inlet, pipe, and pit approach. Okay, so, you know, again, trying to boil it down to simple terms, because one of the things that I always, whenever I come up, the specialists come up to me and talk about stormwater, after the first 5 minutes, I just completely glaze over because it gets so complicated. So one of the things to do is simplify it in a way that we can understand it. So the inlet, pipe, and pit approach is transformed into what, in this case, where we're using three of the 60 tools that we've come up with so far is basically storage, swale, and filter. You know, inlet, pipe, and pit now goes to storage, swale, and filter. Explaining it in simple terms so that people can understand it. The average person can. And then actually working out the details, like, you know, these kind of collective swales, having collective areas of lots that feed into communal swales, and then catchment areas at that scale. And also we did things, you know, just simple things like get from asphalt alleys, which are ridiculous, and, you know, and put in, crushed stone, and also reduce the width of the streets and open the curves up so that on the edges in the T2, we use filtration where it sheets off into the water system and filters through the natural vegetation. So just simple things like that, incredibly simple. And the little pamphlet that we handed out explains that in simple terms too. And so you go from this type of design to this type of design, which if these green areas, you know, these bioswale rain gardens, whatever you want to call them, actually are designed beautifully, they become an amenity to the neighborhood. That's another thing that we have to work on at that level of detail, because the development industry and the builders out there just look at them as like weed pits. You know, that's kind of their impression. And then we have to, you know, design these beautiful gardens. We really have to do a better job from a landscape design point of view. And so this was a simple case study. The aha thing was, in fact, that we went from the cost evaluation from going from the inlet, pipe, and pit approach to this more laying lightly on the land approach is actually where we're able to substantially reduce this heavy-handed infrastructure of the engineers and save a ton of money. In fact, we actually spent more money on tree protection. And so this kind of chart shows you the first 60 acres. The bottom line is that the engineer estimate for doing it the conventional way was about $1.5 million, and then we actually were able to reduce it down to $1 million. So we saved the client $500,000 on the first phase. And that's a great thing from the development side. And it was interesting, the one downside of that is the municipality said, wait a minute, this is cheaper? Well, we don't know about that. Because they're so used to things costing more if they're doing the right thing that, you know, it's completely suspect now. But the thing is, these are you know, techniques that are out there that people are using already. And I think the key is that we can make it smarter, better, and cheaper. And that's kind of the approach that we've talked about in the culture of DPZ, is that we want to do it that way. It's kind of the clean tech, low tech versus the high tech. Gold plating approach. Now, the other side of this too is that municipalities, you know, say, well, we like this idea. We'll let you do that. We want you to do the other thing too. And probably some of you have kind of run into that before. So basically, you have to actually pay twice, which is completely ridiculous. And no one's going to ever do that unless they get some huge grant. So we really want to see if we can again approach this from a holistic point of view to the municipalities and the approval agencies, so something like this can happen. Up front, as opposed to, you know, costing more again. And so just as a reference point, and someone asks us, well, when did y'all start doing this? And I said, well, we've been doing this for years and years at UPC. We go in and actually, you know, redline up the engineering drawings and, you know, simplify them, you know, reduce the gold plating that, you know, those people aren't quite sure that this is, you know, they add extra things to it just to make sure it will work. And so we're very careful about that. And there are a few projects around the country, and y'all have great images. I just have a couple here. That this is Haversham, which is a really beautiful project down in Beaufort County, South Carolina. And before it was called the Smart Code, before it was called the Transect, we were doing things based on the, you know, neighborhood center, neighborhood general, neighborhood edge. This project is now probably 10 years old. And just to show you an example of this kind of transect and feathering up, and you can also kind of notice the kind of ideas about natural drainage and using new types of filtration ponds as part of it, and feathering, you know, of course, all the other things that relate to, you know, kind of a T2 environment, and how you, you know, clearly you can see the kind of the approach we're using here. And then as you feather in towards the community, you know, a 4 to 6 block walk from edge to center, then you can see that things become, you know, the details in all different aspects become less rural and more urban, and you start getting shorter setbacks, and then you start getting streets with, you know, buildings closed, even the introduction of sidewalks, and then also eventually, you know, as you get closer, you end up getting collection points, curb and gutter, and sidewalks, and everything. Things get more dressed up, excuse me, and then, you know, again, it continues on in this trajectory where we're using open space surrounded by higher density to provide that type of environmental quality. And then as you get into the town center, things also get more urban, and you start dealing with things like, well, now we have to talk about, you know, more urban tools like storage areas, and especially with mixed use, and then the main streets looking, applying different tools. But all, you know, it's not like picking one tool for one project. It's about picking different tools for different zones in the transect. So you get these very urban experiences, but also when you step out, you're connected to really wonderful gardens, but also more natural drainage areas. And then, of course, the idea of how you deal with these little compact places and gardens. And then, and this was something, another little tool that was the was worked on a civic site, which instead of putting everything in pipe, we used these really interesting swale designs, which we think the kids love, and they run up around and running in and out of them, and it actually it's really enhanced the character of this area. It's a very attractive and actually a very simple approach. It's basically pea gravel and grass, and basically these walkways, bridges that take you down into a filtration pond. So it's a very simple idea again. And using these types of techniques, this was just built, so it's a little raw right now. But also the other idea that, you know, incorporating a couple other tools, like instead of doing the, you know, like, I don't know, every time y'all go to like a your health club and you park in the parking lot, it's usually the hottest parking lot on earth, you know, because it's out, you know, somewhere. And we actually used an old hedgerow and actually used pervious pea gravel stone as part of the parking lot, so that you actually, when you drive up your car, shade. So just simple things like that. And then, you know, using the water from the drainage to supply irrigation for the community gardens. I mean, these are all very, just very simple ideas. And you ultimately end up, you know, working, again, laying lightning on the land and using the landscape versus, you know, the kind of serious grading that can happen if you're careful. So that's all I have. And I'm going to turn it over to the next slide. While we're making this short break here, I'll talk loud for a minute. How many West Coast folks we have in the room?
About,
not quite that much.
How about Seattleites?
Portlanders?
Okay. Wow, I expect a few more. I just came back from a trip to the Pacific Northwest, and at a different scale of intensity, a much more urban scale of intensity. I was impressed as I've ever been with the city for what they're doing in their downtown. And you got some pictures in yours. Hook this up. I can't do things along. So, and thinking about urbanism as a function within nature, you know, what is a man, man is nature. You know, we're thinking about how to integrate our activities into growth of cities. Portland, in the last 3 years, with the stuff they've been doing up by Portland State University, it's worth a field trip. All right, let's get you up a little bit.
While you're doing that, can we ask questions of Tom? Tom, I have a question about Habersham. If you were to do that project again now, would you have, you see those big green areas in the town center with curves, would you have instead drained into those green areas with the streets? Because right now the large green areas in the downtown are raised and you're not draining
right. Actually, I think what's going to happen is once they finish the main street, I think actually it's going to become even more urban. So there's opportunity to do that. Right now there's actually azaleas planted where people are trying to cross the street. Right. So I think there are opportunities to continue to retrofit that. But yeah, that's a great tool. I think you might be presenting that idea here. But, absolutely.
We'll take some more questions later on. I think Tom's example of Habersham and a few of the other ones supported the idea that I mentioned earlier, is looking toward nature for some ideas for design and making these things that you're putting in place actually read like they're part of the bigger system. They connect you visually and logically. Those were good examples at that intensity. Save your questions. We'll break in 20 some minutes with Wesley. This is Wesley Horner from KW.
Thanks very much. We're delighted to be here. I think one of the things that we wanted to, the one point that we wanted to make was we've been applying these different techniques now for 20, sometimes 25 years. And even though some of these management practices may seem new and innovative, they are in fact new and innovative, nevertheless they are proven and they're not experimental, and we really wanted to hone in on that. I have a list of top 10 BMPs for consideration in new urbanist projects that in our minds are absolutely proven and can work for you tomorrow, even though we still have plenty to learn, and we may be smarter than we were, there still is a way to go. All of our stormwater and water resource work tries to understand better this relationship between land and water, and our feeling is that boy, we really haven't done a very good job of that in the past, and you really have to delve into that surface water, groundwater, and land use much more carefully if you want to understand water quality and water quantity and the way our hydrologic systems work. And so we think that's fundamentally where we start. And we always like a little note of history. Here in Philly, William Penn era, wonderful high-density mixed-use development surrounded by this marvelous green sponge that is just so delightful. It offers so many functions in terms of water resources management. From Smart Growth to then, of course, this, and we're preaching to the choir, and we just seem to have forgotten how to do it the right way. Oblivion, and as oblivion approaches environmentally, it's a real mess. We've done some things with these pits and these pipes, as Tom said, but boy, it just hasn't done very much for us in terms of the volume of water, too much water, and then too little water. Flooding, drought, reduced groundwater levels, zapping stream-based flows, zapping wetlands, all of the above, and God knows the list goes on, and we could spend another conference talking about all these things till the cows come home. Simply put, you know, if we're concerned about sustainability, macro level, we got to get the watershed right with these concepts, as Bob explained. We got to get the development site right. We got to get it right lot by lot. And so you got to keep that tier, that scale in mind as we willy-nilly continue to obliterate our watersheds from one end to the other. Getting the watershed right through new urbanist smart growth strategies, and there's a lot I had to read all these slides that have gone on much too long. Some of you may be familiar with them, but there is guidance, albeit not perfect, that can help us out. LEED, Awani principles, all kinds of different things that we can look at. And what this is, there's a table downstairs with a lot of good stuff now out from EPA that's demonstrating how we can make density happen the right way and how important that density is from a watershed perspective. And, you know, if we can put people into urbanist concepts of density, and it basically chews up far less watershed area, it generates far less impervious cover, it generates far less non-point source pollutant loadings. And so moving from this on that watershed scale, you know, controlling for the same amount of people, the same number of houses, and the same quality of life is absolutely fundamentally essential. And so we've got to start doing it that way. Though I'm not going to talk too much about that and how important that is. Tom started it, and I think that's probably uppermost in lots of minds as well, but it's certainly a critical concept. What I am going to talk about is more specifically getting it right site by site, lot by lot, and what can we do tomorrow to make this stuff happen and to get the water back into the ground, deal with the quantity issues that are so essential for stormwater, deal with the quality issues that are so essential for stormwater. And I would really, harp on this notion of hydrologic balance, trying to keep, roughly speaking, the same amount of infiltration, evapotranspiration, runoff after development as before development. And we think that's a really important concept in all of these. And all of these different practices work to make that happen in different ways. Ideally, in new urbanist concepts. And one of the other things that reads, when you think about all of them, is we're doing sort of a dual usage or multiple usage concept. We're trying to tuck our management techniques into a reality where we're already disturbing the zone. You'll see what that means in a minute or two. So we think this multiple usage is important. For 30 years, we've been using porous pavement with underground recharge beds to great effect in the right types of settings with the right types of uses. It can work beautifully. And certainly, in many new urbanist, TOD, TND concepts, we are going to continue to build large areas of parking, congregate parking zones. What we do, we can use porous pavement and then tuck an underground recharge bed, 40% void space, gives you volume control, puts all the stormwater, not only from the parking lot, but from adjacent structures, back into the ground. By the time it gets through if it's a reasonable soil, and we check that soil very carefully, initially it comes out, assuming it's not a hotspot land use, it comes out with an excellent water quality. So we get superb peak rate control, total volume control, water quality control. And we're using the parking lot as the stormwater management device. It has some added cost, but oftentimes in many contexts, we've actually reduced, as Tom was mentioning, we've actually reduced the total site development budget. We can give you those examples. Here's one. This is 25 years old, not too far from where we're sitting, down outside of Wilmington, Delaware. You know, the development is pretty crappy. So don't look at the building. Don't look at the design. Original concept, we were expanding these structures And so this is going to be a nice big detention basin. Let's get rid of all the trees that happen to remain. Put the storm water there. Wouldn't that be wonderful? Uh-oh, bad idea. Let's basically save the woods, save the vegetation that's remaining. Let's to redirect all the structure and the parking lot into stormwater basins. DuPont manufactured the pipe. DuPont manufactured the filter fabric. This is the underground recharge bed, so they made a lot of money as they did a better job for the environment. So this is now 25 years old and has been functioning beautifully. It is an R95 office park, relatively modest non-point source pollutant loadings. A relatively recent hurricane runoff from the conventional ring road into the parking. It's raining like cats and dogs. All of it gets tucked into and returned to the aquifers back into the ground. Works like a charm. Another one out in not too far from here. You know, these are dormitories, but it could be a higher density concept. Once again, this is all porous pavement underlain by a large stone-filled recharge bed. Simple cartoon directing it. And again, the concept is dual usage here. Siemens, yet another one. These are both these examples, SmithKline, SMS, Siemens. You can drive it not too far from here. They're between 20 and 25 years of age, been functioning at exceptional value streams over limestone. It's as tricky a combination as you could get. They work beautifully, and it could work in congregate parking areas in new urbanist contexts, of which you will have many. That's just an example of a concept. And you can play around with these techniques. It can be in adjacent parking areas, along streams. These are our friend Tom Lipton for the city of Portland has done some really nice applications. Can be very attractively topped. Doesn't have to be asphalt. Of course, asphalt, of course, concrete. Can be brick pavers. You can make it much more attractive and sort of add to the, enhance the aesthetics of your site. And there's a variety of different products now on the market that they may add marginally to the overall cost, but they can really significantly improve the concept. But the point is they're managing the stormwater very, very effectively in a comprehensive way. You can actually use the same techniques in backyards. We're retrofitting already developed, badly developed stormwater systems in suburban areas in with patios, front yard walkways, backyard walkways, and whatnot. This is a porous concrete sidewalk out in State College. Just the example, a few blocks just to the west in West Philadelphia, a new school, Penn Alexander School. This is a playing field, basketball play area. This is all a stormwater management system. This was in Philly. You've got combined sewers, huge problem. Many old urban areas have that. What this done with, it did was redirect the stormwater from the structure into this basketball area. So it's a play area, an active play area, as well as a stormwater management device, significantly reducing the CSO problem in the city. And you can use, it doesn't have to be pour any kind of porous pavement. The idea is to get the water under these developed or paved areas and use that area, again, as a dual usage stormwater infiltration system. This is out of Villanova University. It's a retrofit of a large, attractively designed plaza and walkway area, high utility. Most of it is, in fact, conventional, but underneath this whole area, this is all a stormwater infiltration system. And so this is several feet deep. It has stone filled, and it grabs the water and gets it back into the ground with also excellent water quality. Rain gardens. Tom mentioned rain gardens. We love rain gardens. Relatively simple, but in this case, what we're doing is simply planting the area. It's got a stormwater volume control, filter fabric wrapped system. Put a planting mix on top. That's usually the way we design them. Here's some applications. New library in highly urban Wilmington. One out in Portland. high-density multi-family residential complex. These are the stormwater management devices, and so, you know, this is solving the stormwater problem in a very comprehensive way, quantity and quality wise, and adding a lovely landscape feature to the overall development. And so, as Tom said, there's actually no reason why we can't turn these problems into great opportunities. Some even in nasty low-density single-family developments. The State College Visitor Center, that's a lousy slide, and so there's a variety of different applications. Really, there's just no end in sight. Given our fixation on volume control and infiltration, we can apply this in a variety of ways as well. We like it with active, we can incorporate active recreational areas that you're always going to have. I noticed there was one in the one slide you showed, Tom. This is at that same school in West Philly. There's a large soccer play area. This large soccer play area has been designed with an infiltration system underneath it, and it takes vast amounts of stormwater in addition to the paved basketball area that I showed you a few minutes ago. And so this is taking all the major school area and redirecting that stormwater underneath the play area. It dries out very, very quickly. They have no problem using it for active recreational play. And so that's another possibility. Use those active rec areas to best advantage for stormwater as well. I just stole this one, Stapleton. Some of you probably, you may be involved with this, but hey, man, that's a great stormwater opportunity. We can turn that into a wonderful stormwater management device for these feature areas. And passive recreational areas. You know, there's an enormous number of small mini greens, park areas that are incorporated. You can almost imagine Savannah and Oglethorpe developing these city squares and using them for stormwater management devices. This is actually one in the silly one in a almost new urbanist design in Pasco County, Florida. And they put in these little parklets or whatever you want to call them, and they're all over the place. And they're, I mean, theoretically, they're nice. Curved, crowned, and there's massive amounts of precious water in irrigation systems unsuccessfully, desperately trying to keep them watered. Silly idea, just subtly depress it, turn it into a green area, it becomes a solution and not a problem. And so there are these opportunities out there waiting for us. This was one that we did 25 years ago. This is an office park in Allentown, once again in a highly cheesy limestone formation. And these guys, this has become a big ball field. And so even though it is the stormwater infiltration basin device, it works beautifully, no sinkholes. It is also a passive recreational area. And so you can incorporate these things as recreational facilities. This is go down to the Washington National Cathedral, and what we've done is grabbed all the stormwater from the cathedral and adjacent parking areas. This is Olmsted's Rock Creek Park, which is just below the cathedral. And so we've terraced a bunch of, in this case, not crushstone-filled infiltration systems, but these sort of like hollow Legos, water storage devices down the slope, and allows the water to replenish the high hiking trails, the oaks that are so important down in Rock Creek Park. Lots of opportunities to do this. You know, some of you are familiar, new urbanist concepts lend themselves very nicely to green roofs. This isn't getting the water back into the ground, but in great tank situations, this can be an interesting concept. A little bit pricey, though. It's a very dandy concept in terms of energy savings. Chicago City Hall here, and used now for years throughout Europe. This is one that we just finished down in Chapel Hill, we've done a lot of work for the University of North Carolina. This green garden grabs stormwater. It also happens to be about an eight-story structured parking garage, and on one side of the structured parking garage is a huge cistern. And so we're saving water, we're evapotranspiring water, and we're using it for a multiple concept sort of courtyard. The university, this was in a major sort of depression in the campus, and they wanted sort of a featured courtyard here. And so this is brand new, and if you're down there, we heartily recommend that you go see it. Again, lots of these things have been functioning, courtyards have been functioning green roofs functioning for quite a few years. This is again actually on top of about a 10-story structured parking area. It's the courtyard in the hospital that provides a wonderful amenity for patients who can who are able to utilize the courtyard. We redid the Ford Motor Company's Rouge River assembly plant that now has the world's largest green roof. That's it. Starts out life about as much of a black field as you can possibly get, and it's gradually making its way into, at least a greener field of some sort. So there really is a chance to do remarkable things in terms of both quantity and quality. Love cisterns, rain barrels, capture, reuse, much more micro, lot by lot basis, interesting for retrofitting in a variety of ways. This is actually a cistern, sculptured as a device in the entryway, and so we save the water in this clever little